Podcast, and as always, we have Michael Schauff, Caleb Curtis, and me, Jerome Lovelady. We're back again, kind of doing a continuation on our pediatric neonatal vent series. You know, guys, I got to ask you, how's things going today? How are you doing today?
It's cold.
Pretty good.
It's cold.
I don't like cold weather.
It's not as cold as where Schauff is, I'm sure. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
It's cold in the north.
It's cold here, but I think it's 40 degrees or something like that. So it's not terrible, I guess, but it's cold enough for me not to like it. So with that, guys, kind of a continuation of what we were doing earlier with some of the stuff we were talking about with neonates and pediatrics. I'm just going to kind of back on out of the conversation, kind of asked Mr. Schauff here to kind of lead us off here and just kind of give him the reins and let's go with it.
All right. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Jerome. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Yeah, so talking about neonatal pediatric, and we talked about this a little bit on the last podcast, but I need to just reiterate that my heart goes out to you people that are out there picking up these babies and, you know, medics and nurses that haven't worked in the ICUs and haven't had a lot of time or experience with neonates and pediatrics. And you're going in there and you're saving their lives. They have to get to a higher level of care. I get it. But man, oh man, I see some of these charts that I'm reading and these kids are sick. You know, and if you're not used to the settings on the ventilator and what they need to support them, it's a challenge. You know, you need to phone a friend. You need the experience. We talked about NRP and the PALS and especially the stable program. But you also need some experience as to what the ventilator settings are. They're not exactly the same on a smaller basis than the adults. So let's basically talk about that. You get to the bedside of a kid, let's say he's, 500, 600 gram, 1,000 gram kid, 1 kilogram kid. And, you know, what are you going to set him up at? Or what was he on? And you want to make sure they're on the right settings. Is he volume targeted or pressure targeted? Is your machine going to be able to match what the hospital machine is doing? If you got called to that hospital or critical care center, whatever it is, you know, what are they on the hospital ventilator? And can your ventilator do it? I mean, is your ventilator rated to go down to 1 kilogram? That's something you should know right off the bat, right? So I know some of the machines are 5 kilograms, some are 3 kilograms. The one that we've been using on our neonatal transport units goes down to 0.2 kilograms, which is really, you know, what you need for these kids, this size, something small, thinner circuits, smaller circuits. Really, really important on the ones that we use. We use the Hamilton T1. They have the flow sensor that's really sensitive, proximal, right to the ET tube, right there. And that, when the kid wants a breath, they get it right away, you know, and you're getting accurate measurements from that flow sensor being right there. So that, to me, is really, really important. I've done a lot of transports with the cross vent, and they had a option to put a flow sensor there too, and it was pretty sensitive. And I've done a lot of transports with the MVP-10, the Biomed MVP-10, which is just pneumatically driven forced air in, and you hit a pressure and you're not getting many monitored values back. You just jam an air into that lung. And we've had success with that too. I mean, you can always make it work, but today's technology has advanced so much. We absolutely love the fact that this Hamilton T1 could go down to 0.2 kilograms and does it well. Anyway, so, you know, with the neo patient, we're looking at tidal volumes. You know, some literature says 4 to 6 milliliters per kilogram. We in the neonatal unit, I work in AIM for 5 to 7 milliliters per kilogram, somewhere in that area. The minute volume targeting is like 0.2 to 0.3 liters per minute. The one thing that, so you got to decide you're going to deliver it in a volume or a pressure. Most of the time when I'm using the Hamilton, I would basically go for a pressure target, right? And look at my exhale tidal volumes and find out what I'm looking for. The one thing, and this is true in the, adult world, nobody looks at the inspiratory time. Nobody pays attention. And I will say, in the neonatal unit, the level three NICU that I worked in, they will write for an eye time. And there's a specific reason for that.
You the really, forgotten setting.
Yeah, the, it is. It's the lost setting in the adult world. You'll probably get it in the peds world, but you need it in the, you need it in all, right, for flow delivery and patient comfort and things like that. But in, for the most part, you really need it in the neonatal world, right? A typical adult eye time is 0.9 seconds, 1 second per breath. But with the neonates, I've seen them as high, even a kid on transport, I've read charts where, you know, a 1 gram kid has an eye time of 0.6. That's way too long, right? So, you know, on average, a preterm kid is 0.3 to 0.35. I've seen it a little lower, a little higher. And a full-term kid is like 0.35 to 0.4. That's seconds, 0.4 seconds. That's a quick breath, right? Because remember, they're breathing in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, right? If they're intubated, there's a problem. They're usually tachypneic. So you don't want a long eye time to cause air trapping, right? You got to watch that eye to E ratio. So those are some of the bare bone basic settings. PEEP, you titrate for oxygenation. PEEPs of 6 or 7 is common with ARDS kind of kids. PIE, you might go a little lower. So let's talk about RDS, respiratory distress syndrome. Typically, that's a surfactant deficiency, right? So these kids are premature. They don't have as much surfactant as they really need. So they basically have a stiff kind of a lung, a low compliant lung. So they're going to need a little bit higher pressures. And we typically go up on the PEEP, right? 6, 7, 8, something like that, to help oxygenate, to open up those airways, right? Now, the BPD, the bronchopulmonary dysplasia kids, those kids are hyperinflated. I call them mini COPDers. They have a really high compliant lung. They just have a lot of high resistance, right? They have small diameter airways, right? And you just got to be aware of that flow that you're sending in there. Is it going to be laminar or turbulent flow? Turbulent flow is not wanted. So if you're sending the flow in too fast, it creates that chaotic flow, which drives the pressure up even higher, and the lungs don't get to see it as good. You got to be aware of their elastic recoil, right? And that has to do with the lungs, the chest wall, and the diaphragm returning to their original state. So when you're giving a breath in positive pressure, if they have poor elastic recoil, that lung takes a lot of time to get back to its original state. Some kid with a peanut with RDS, they have really quick time constant, we'll call it, right? So that's like that lung deflates really quickly because of that poor compliant lung. So you just got to be aware of those things when you do it, because you don't want to air trap these kids, right? So oxygenation, well, remember, right, ventilation is determined by respiratory rate times your desired tidal volume, and that equals your minute volume. And we got to be aware of those settings. We just talked about that. The respiratory rates can go from anywhere from 20, 30, 40, depending if they're breathing on their own, triggering breaths. Do you want to be in AC mode? Do you want to be in SIMV mode? Typically with these kids, to prevent air trapping, we put them in SIMV with a pressure support breath or a volume guarantee, depending what type of machine you have. I would, Hamilton, I would go to a pressure delivered breath, and I might even go to an SIMV breath, titrating that pressure support to see what they need, right? To see what kind of tidal volumes I'm getting back. Anytime you come up on any patient, you're going to mechanically ventilate. You want to make sure in your mind you have a target tidal volume that you're shooting for, whether you're volume targeting or pressure targeting. You always want to look at that exhale tidal volume and make sure it's within that range that you want to be in, right? So with oxygenation, you want to look at the mean airway pressure, essentially, right? Oxygenation, we talk about FiO2 and PEEP. But in the end, with these kids, it's all about the mean airway pressure, right? And that involves 5 different things. The flow, the peak inspiratory pressure, the eye time, the PEEP, and the respiratory rate all add to the mean airway pressure. And that just means how much pressure is in the airway during the cycle of one breath. And that means, when you think about it, how open those lungs are to receive the oxygen, right? So what we do sometimes in the NICU is we will go ahead and, when we start approaching mean airway pressures of over 14, which is relatively high, Remember, PEEP correlates exactly with mean area pressure. So my PEEP is 6, my mean airway is 6. And then the breath gets on top of that, it adds to the mean airway pressure. So if my mean airway pressure starts to go higher than 14 and I'm not reaching my oxygenation goals via ABG, VBG, or capillary blood gas, however we're going to draw these gases to confirm oxygenation and ventilation, I'm going to start thinking of another way to ventilate. And some of those ways differ, but we're going to talk about maybe high-frequency oscillation and maybe some high-frequency jet ventilation. Right, two different types of ventilation. The oscillation, high-frequency oscillator, we've done a study back in the early 90s, SIMV versus high-frequency oscillation. It was an international study, and we ended up stopping the study probably, I forgot how, I think we had 1,500 or 2,000 participants. We ended up stopping the study because we found out the high-frequency oscillator was much, much better than the SIMV delivery. And to briefly touch on it, high frequency oscillation blows up the lung to a mean airway pressure of, let's say, 10 or 12. And we'll check that on the ribs to diaphragm with an X-ray if that's appropriate. You want to go 9 to 10 on the right side. And that's the oxygenation part. And then we'll oscillate from there. And with a high frequency oscillator, it is an active exhalation. So you're actually driving this speaker-like device with magnets and you're pushing air in and you're pulling air out. And it's just, it's minimal amount of, you can't even measure a tidal volume. It's a minimal amount, it's less than dead space. And the way that it creates ventilation is through what they call the Pendeloff effect. I don't want to go deep into it, but that's how it happens, right? And we found this to be a great way to oxygenate and ventilate a kid who's got high pressures, because you're not stretching the lung. You're not throwing that driving pressure in 40 breaths per minute, right? You're holding the lung open to a certain amount of pressure and oxygenating and ventilating from there with the frequency and the delta P or change in pressure. And it's minimal. So that worked out really well. And then Bonnell came out with a jet ventilator, which is a lot more gentler, right? So it's more of a flow interrupter kind of a thing where it throws flow in. It's a passive exhalation versus the active exhalation of the Sensormatics 3000. So just be aware that there's different ways that we ventilate kids in the NICU. Now, there are some transport, definitely some transport high-frequency machines, right? The Fabian is used a lot. You see that overseas. And the one thing that I will say is if you're going to do some kid with a jet ventilation, you need to take the RT with you. This is not something that, you know, your standard critical care transport team, if they're not neonatal savvy, they're not going to be running that. And there's a lot of teams that do that. They use the Airborne TXP-20. That's a flow interrupter. The Bernal is actually a jet pulse, they call it. So, it's just a softer, gentler way to do the same thing. So I guess, you know, there's a lot of different variables in there. You want to look at what the lung disease is. Why are they intubated? Is the tube placement proper? Is the right size tube? Do we have any leaks? Sometimes if you have a big leak, you can overcome that by just increasing your PEEP a little bit. And just be aware of that. Constantly take X-rays. And on transport, it's a challenge. That's pretty much what I got to say. So know the settings. Phone a friend. Get used to it, get online and figure out some of the, you know, talk to medical control, of course. And again, I can't stress enough, some of these really sick kids, that's why they have specialty teams, right? They have neonatal pediatric specialty teams for this exact reason, because it's so highly specialized that these people that go on these transport teams work in these units all the time. So they're familiar with these lung diseases and things. So.
Yep, and you can tell it's complicated because you can hear his papers in the background shuffling around, looking through the notes and everything else. I mean, it does. So part of my job on this one is to translate, because this is an area where I feel like I don't have enough experience on this one. I have it in the transport world, but definitely not into the as far as the depths and stuff of what it would actually do. So I'm going to ask some questions on this one, definitely. So, because I'm going to translate. So first part I would do want to talk about before I start asking him some of the questions is, let's say that you get there for the transport world and your ventilator does not go down. There's limitations. You heard him talk about some of the limitations of the ventilator and why that actually happens, because some of them are not approved, or some of them actually have limitations of actually going down to 5 kilograms, 3 kilograms, whatever else that it is, because of the flow that is actually there, or sometimes the bias flow also has to be taken into consideration on this one too. So give you a heads up on that one, Shaw, just in a minute, let you talk about the bias flow. But the first thing I do want to talk about is, like, let's talk about some of the other things. And this is not necessarily the best way to transport them, but sometimes we are the only option, as many of you, I'm sure, that are listening to this has felt this. So the T-piece resuscitator, you heard us talk about it in the first podcast. And so kind of get a chance to actually talk about some specifics of it on this one. So it is gas powered. It is variable. It is PEEP variable, which means that the flow is actually going to determine the amount of PEEP that's actually being delivered to the patient. So you have to set it first. You have to actually connect it to a gas powered source, to either some type of cylinder, oxygen cylinder, or to a wall outlet, whichever one that it is. But it kind of works into it works into the point of where you first set the flow. After you set the flow on the gauge, then you're going to set the PEEP and the pressure. And it's actually better for guaranteed pressure for the patient, for especially less than 10 kilograms is what most of these are actually related are rated to. And so you'll have to get the specifics of the manufacturer specifics, which one's every one that you're using. But setting the flow first, getting the PEEP dialed in, getting the getting the pressure dialed in too, and trying to see what you're seeing on the manometer as you're actually ventilating this kid on the ET tube. So that's the first thing. It does work by actually occluding the tip of it, and that's actually where it actually delivers the pressure to the kid. And then you're constantly monitoring it on either on end-tidal CO2 or in the SpO2 readings off of there. So that's the first thing. But the other one is, you know, there's been a big talk of minute ventilation and how much minute ventilation that I'm actually using to ventilate these kids. And so I talk about it in the principles of cardiac output versus minute ventilation. Respiratory drives cardiac drives drives respiratory. The two are interchangeable, but you screw one up, you're going to have to deal with the other one very quickly. And so that looks at the VQ, looking at the ventilation to perfusion. And when you have mismatches, sometimes the kid's cardiac output and demands a certain specific minute ventilation. And I'll get to Shalfa here in just a minute of how we're actually looking at that, measuring that on there. But that's just a breakdown. They two have to be equal, or that's how you actually get the ventilation to perfusion mismatch. And so a lot of people, when they put the patients on the ventilator, is they forget that. But there is a certain amount of minute ventilation that you can actually give too much of, and then that's when it actually causes increased thoracic pressure and causes hemodynamic cardiac compromise from that one. So I'll let him take that question real quick, because I do want to talk about, two or three other points. So, Shaf, what do you think about minute ventilation? What do you typically gauge? What's the reference points here for this one?
Yeah. So, for them to equal, just to clarify, it's 4 liters of air, 5 liters of blood, right, running by the capillaries. Yep. And that would be the VQ ratio that you're looking for. Anytime that's affected, of course, is... Caleb said, you're screwed. You got to kind of catch yourself and figure out what's happening and why and fix it, right? The minute volume we were looking at before was, we're aiming for on a healthy lung 0.2 to 0.3 liters per minute. And that's usually obtained by giving the appropriate tidal volume based on their size, right? You got to know their kilogram and weight. And then you put a rate anywhere from 30 to 40, somewhere around there. And then we do capillary blood gases. You could probably get an arterial blood gas to start out with to see how you're oxygenating. We do capillary, just look at the pH and the CO2 and everything else that we could get. Obviously, the O2 is going to be way low, but we have values that we go by. Another way to do it is transcutaneous monitoring. So we could do that and get our CO2. Transcutaneous monitoring, so we don't have to keep poking the kid for blood. But that's your gold standard, right? Is to draw blood on the kid, send it to the lab, and see if you're effectively oxygenating and ventilating. And if you fall out of favor on any one of those, you have to make adjustments. If you're not oxygenating well, you either go up on the FiO2 a little bit, and we have standards of that. If we're hitting, you know, oxygen of 40%, we don't want to, you know, give these kids ROP, right, in the NICU.
Right.
You know, and to your point of using the NEOT that's driven off 100% oxygen off the wall, if you have a blender set up, that's more ideal run that NEOT, because you want to start low and aim high, or go a little bit higher. You don't 100% oxygen for a short period of time. If the kid needs to get to a higher level of care for various reasons, that'll work. That's fine. But we try to stay away from that oxygen toxicity and the risk of ROP, which takes a while. But less is more when it comes to FiO2, and that's really, really important in the NICU world. So, yeah, I mean, just base it on, you know, typical settings, 20 to 30 to 40 breaths per minute, based on the tidal volume. Make sure your pressures don't go too high, right? You don't want your PIPs to be too high. And look at your blood gases from that point on and adjust accordingly. And we do like to use that non-invasive transcutaneous monitoring for the CO2. And we trend it. It's not always accurate if the kid has poor perfusion or is mottled or anything like that. It's not very accurate at all, but you can see it rise or go low or go high, whatever. One thing, if you're going to put that we should talk about, if you're going to do end-tidal CO2 on a little bit bigger kid, you're adding dead space to that kid. And if he's only getting 4 milliliters of tidal volume, that dead space you just added with the end-tidal CO2 device is going to make a difference. You know, you can watch the CO2 climb up a little bit, because, you know, 4 milliliters in a kid who's getting 3 milliliters is a lot of dead space. So just be aware of that. Anything that's you put on top of that circuit beyond the Y, that's really, really important. A lot of people overlook that. And the bias flow you hit on earlier, bias flow, just by definition, is flow blowing through the circuit continuously. And that means on exhalation too, right? So that just makes sure there's fresh gas for the next breath to come through. They're not rebreathing what's in that circuit at the Y. And it also really helps the patient, whether it be an adult ped or a neo patient, it helps them trigger the next breath that they want. Because if they're sucking through dead air, it's harder for them to suck through dead air than it is if there's a 3 liter or 4 liter bias flow running through that circuit. And that's why you'll see that some vents allow you to adjust it. Some vents don't. The Hamilton is not adjustable to my knowledge. And then you have the Revel that you can adjust down to 4 liters. And the LTV 1200 is either off or on, right, from 10 liters to nothing. So there is some discrepancy of where to let that go. But I think you just have to know your equipment first before you make any decisions based on that.
Right. And I think, so the next thing is, I heard you talk about flow. And so for translating for us, you know, sometimes we get to the ventilator, the settings and the teachings and stuff, and we go right past this one sometimes. And I really have to talk about how P-Ramp actually adjusted or what we can actually do to impact the flow. So I know it's ventilator dependent and depending on the settings and stuff that we're actually using, but can you talk about just a few minutes about how we're using these settings to adjust the flow and what we're looking at on some of these kids, depending on what types of vents that we're actually using?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because on the cross vent that I've used quite a bit on our earlier sleds, is we had a flow adjustment for that, and that kind of confuses people too. Typically, in volume ventilation, flow is determined by eye time and volume, the target tidal volume. And that's a set flow. Pressure ventilation is a little bit different by the way it's delivered, which is usually a decelerating waveform. And it allows for more flow available if the patient's breathing spontaneously. Now, if you want to talk about P-ramp, that is the initial milliseconds of that flow going in. And you can adjust that if you see on your tracing on your screen, if you have a graphics, let's say on the Hamilton T1, and you see a spike, right, in your initial breath going in, that means that your gas, your flow is going in too fast, right? So remember, these kids have a really high airway resistance. They have really small airways. So when you create turbulent flow, meaning too much gas, right, coming in too fast, you're going to see these spikes on that pressure scale.
Right.
And that's where I would come in and maybe, you know, fine tune it a little bit, because that could create like a shearing effect within the bronchioles, and that's not good either. And that gets deep into the gas law thing, but turbulent flow is not good. Laminar flow is good. You want to create a more slower. So I would go into P ramp in the more section of the Hamilton. And I would walk that P ramp back off the, I think it's a 70 millisecond on that, and walk it back maybe to 120. Just watch and make sure that that little spike on the pressure scale, the initial breath going in, goes away. I would try to take that spike out of there. It's just a red flag telling you that that gas is going in too fast. Maybe the eye time is too low. You know, you want to have that eye time in that range, depending on its size. Excuse me, anywhere between 0.25 and 0.35, maybe a bigger kid, 0.4. But if you drop it around 0.25 and you have a 2.5 ET tube and the kid's like a 450 grammer, you know, you're going to expect some turbulent flow, right? That's right. The way it works. So
I hope that. And that segues into the next one, because you talked about the mean airway pressure, and you were also talking about the total eye time too, and how, but for the most part, I think some people still don't correlate oxygenation with mean airway pressure. We learned this a lot with the COVID patients, and that taught us a lot on there. Most people think about oxygenation as FiO2 and PEEP. So I did like the way that you actually talked about the mean airway pressure, but remembering these total cycle time for these kids could be 1 second, because there could be breathing 60 times a minute, depending on what you're what you're actually transporting. So what about the eye time setting to, and what, how much MAP is too much, or what are we talking about here for trying to increase some look at the eye time adjustments for these kids?
Yeah, it's really a tough call. I would go with standard eye times, because the longer you make the eye time, the closer you're bringing the I to E ratio together, and you're at risk of air trapping, right? So typically with these kids, PEEP is really your go-to for oxygenation, right? The byproduct of the mean airway pressure coming up is the rate, the pressure, and the eye time, right? And actually the E time is part of the equation too, how much E time is in there. The limit, like I said earlier, is when we start approaching mean airway pressures on conventional ventilation of upwards of 14 and we're not oxygenating appropriately, that's when we switch over to that jet ventilation, right? Because I'll put a PEEP of 10 or 12 on this kid and then ventilate from there. So now I'm popping those alveoli open with a mean airway pressure on my machine. It'll be called a PEEP, but it's really the mean airway pressure. I drive it up to whatever, 12, 14. I'll measure it with an X-ray on my my right diaphragm. And so that's my oxygenation, really. And then I'll just go ahead and ventilate with that flow interrupter. Yeah, cool. Anything else?
All right. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a lot of information and stuff for today, because we're right up against our time. I think we try to keep these between 30 minutes, 35 minutes, somewhere in between there. So I think that kind of gives us a good segue and stuff into some of the modes and stuff for some of these kids a little bit later on. I do have some more questions about the volume versus the pressure, but I believe that we can cover that in the next one. But you got something else, Shaw?
Yeah, I just want to say, because it's so highly specialized, you know, we're giving you some generic settings, some different ideas of things that are going on. People do things, different parts of the country, different parts of the world, different ways, right? Any mechanically ventilated patients, like Baskin and Robbins, there's so many different approaches and different things. Just check with your medical coordinator. Just check with your director, your neonatologist, whoever's in charge of your operation. Make sure you're doing what they tell you to do, because there's a lot of different ways to do this. And I'm not telling you the way I'm doing it's the right way. I'm just giving you my experience in the field. But there's a lot of different ways, so double check.
No, it's a good point. We always talk to, when I teach this, is like sometimes the best thing that you can actually do is make a phone call before you leave the sending facility. You know, a lot of the sending facilities that you're coming up and you're getting these rescue or retrieves, or and you treat them like basically sing calls and stuff sometimes too. They're doing the best with what they've got there, but again, this is a specialized population. So contact the receiving facilities, talk to the neonatologist, talk to the pediatric intensivist, whichever one, to make sure and verify some of these settings. If it's
nurse practitioners and PAs are really helpful too. You talk to the PA and the nurse practitioner and they're all over it. You know, if they're caring for the patient, get their input, get their suggestions, look ahead. If something goes south, what's plan B, what's plan C, you know? So just have that ready. Yeah.
So we good of wrapping it up for today?
Yeah. If you guys could see the note, if you guys could see the pencil that I'm writing with, it's smoking right now. Just saying. As always, tons of information. Great stuff. But yeah, guys, we're right up against our time limit where we typically want to keep these things. As always, keep sending us emails, keep sending us little tidbits of information here and there. We love seeing you guys send stuff over. criticalcaretriad@outlook.com. Also, if you hadn't followed us yet, I'm going to keep saying it, guys. Follow us again. And I guess until then, we will see you guys later.
We're growing.
Yes. Yes.
How many countries are we in right now? We're growing.
Oh, man. What was that?
64 countries, and we're over 10,000 downloads right now.
Nice. 64 countries and 10,000 downloads. I would like to see 128 countries and 100,000 downloads.
That would be nice.
Just saying.
100K. Yeah.
That'd be nice. I know you guys can do it for us.
All that paper rumbling in the background was the money I was counting too.
Yeah, because we do this for money. So
yeah, exactly. Ain't that true?
It's all free. Yeah.
Disclaimer: we do not get paid for this.
Exactly.
No, we do not. This is for fun. So your gift to us and the way you guys could pay us is by following us and shooting us an email. We'll take that. So thank you guys again. And until then, we'll talk to you guys next time. We'll see you guys later.
Bye-bye. Be safe.
The information provided in this podcast is intended for educational and informational purposes only. It is not intended to be a substitute for medical direction or training. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the organization or institution that they may represent. The listeners are advised that the information contained in this podcast should be used in conjunction with professional medical training and best practice guidelines. The host and guests of this podcast take no responsibility for the actions or decisions of the listeners.